episode of Weed Wonks is brought to you by our friends over at Cova Software, the number one dispensary point of sale system in North America, with an average of nearly 100 new dispensary clients opening their doors every month. Some of the biggest retail brands and most remote cannabis stores in the U.S. and Canada count on Cova. One of the things that really sets Cova apart from most of its competitors is the fact that this is not Cova's first retail point of sales rodeo. The team behind Cova has been helping retail cannabis stores for two decades now and has helped hundreds of cannabis stores since embracing our relatively new industry. When you have that kind of experience, it shows in all the right ways, because not only does Cova provide obvious things like rock-solid reliability and easy scale, but the Cova folks also know the right ways to bring new clients on board, which makes for a much smoother transition process for you. Take advantage of all the ways that Cova knows point of sale software and open up covasoftware.com to learn more and to get in touch. That's covasoftware.com. We're also glad to have the support this week of our friends over at Agilent, a Fortune 500 company known for providing top-notch testing solutions to cannabis and hemp testing labs worldwide. Are you considering testing your cannabis in-house for potency? Agilent is giving away a free 1260 HPLC system for 1 year. If you're a cultivator, processor, or cannabis testing lab, you may qualify for this giveaway. When you use Agilent's 1260 HPLC system for potency testing, you'll gain immediate access to your data, know when to harvest, and increase your sample throughput. Don't miss out on this 1260 HPLC system giveaway. Swing over to bit.ly.com/cannabis-contest to answer a few quick questions to enter to win. Again, that's bit.ly.com/cannabis-contest.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Weed Wonks, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the changing landscape of laws and regulations. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, partner at the firm VS Strategies. Cranking away at the home bunker, my policy partner in crime, Andrew Livingston, director of economics and research at Vicente Cederberg, will not be joining us today. But as always, when Andrew misses the show, that is the listener's benefit, because it means the two guys from New Jersey will talk less and we get to hear more from our guest, who's really here to share all of their knowledge about things that are going on. And so it is my absolute pleasure to introduce Samuel Richard from the Arizona Dispensaries Association. Samuel is a friend of mine from Arizona. He is the executive director for the Arizona Dispensaries Association, and I've had the great privilege of talking to him about policy and all kinds of nerdy details about testing and dorky things going on in Arizona in the past. And given that in a way, Arizona is suddenly the darling of the marijuana reform world and the cannabis movement generally, given the historic pace at which you've transitioned from medical to retail, it seemed like it would just be amazing to have you on the show and start talking about kind of what's going on in Arizona and share some of the details. And there are few people more intimately aware of the changing policy in Arizona than our good friend Sam. And so first and foremost, Sam, welcome to the Weed Wonks. We're so happy to have you on.
Hey, thanks so much, Jordan. And great to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So why don't we start this, since you are new to the show, although have been a weed wonk for quite some time in actual life. Can you tell us about how, you know, your background in public policy and how you got involved in the cannabis reform movement?
Yeah, so I have been a consumer for longer than I've been on the professional side of the industry. I think that's probably the case for most folks in the work. I was a qualified patient and still am, even though I have the ability here in Arizona to purchase on the adult use side. But my professional background is largely in nonprofit policy management, contract lobbying, and association management as well. So I have been around the space. I've been around the Arizona Capitol and nonprofit work and kind of left of center policy ideas for quite a while. So when the folks behind the initiative were kind of retooling and regrouping the association to support the successful passage of Prop 207, there was an opportunity to come on board as executive director, and I jumped at it, and I haven't looked back.
That's awesome. You know, it's probably around the time I think you and I first connected when you had initially got that gig. About it was about a year ago, I'd say, give or take, maybe a little bit longer than that. One of our good friends, Ryan Hurley, connected us initially. Great guy, great attorney in the space that I've known for a long time. Happy he was able to do it, because he was like, well, if you want to know what's going on in Arizona, I'm happy to talk to you anytime, Jordan, but you really need to talk to Sam. And he did. And so that was great. Now we're here today. So why don't we, before we start talking about Prop 217 and the initiative, why don't we talk a little bit about the Dispensary Association and, you know, kind of who are members and how is that association able to really effectively advocate for the industry in Arizona?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this might be a good opportunity to kind of zoom out just a little bit and talk about the makeup of the Arizona market, because I think the licensure really drives the association world, depending on the market as well. So we are a vertically licensed market, but we are not vertically integrated like Florida, right? So we have the ability to, you know, lease those functions of production in other places, whether it's cultivation or processing, or even some folks lease out the retail portion of their license. So we have kind of a mix of that. Whereas, you know, in a place like Ohio, you might have an association for the retailers, an association for the cultivators, and a separate association for the processors. Here in Arizona, it's all based on that one license. Because of that, we really have just that one association, and it really launched informally with the launch of our program back in 2010. And at the time, was known as DNA, or the Dispensary Networking Association, and was led by many folks who are still in the industry and a handful who have exited successfully. But we have grown and matured along with the industry as well. So we represent about 100 to 115 of the licenses that are in Arizona, of which there are 130, which we'll talk more about that later. And our membership includes those licensed owners as well as affiliate members who have, you know, the ability to operate within the market, but aren't necessarily a license owner themselves. Just one quick example would be an outfit like Alien Labs that calls California home, but operates here in Arizona under the license owned by one of the operators here.
Okay, so basically, if you're running a cannabis business in Arizona, folks should probably at least talk to you and have you on their radar and in their network. How would they go about doing that? I guess, can you share with the listening audience your email or how to contact you in case someone's interested in learning more?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find us on the internet at azdispensaries.org. And my first name's Sam, just Sam at azdispensaries.org is me. We're also on all of the social media that are friendly to cannabis. So we're on LinkedIn, we're on Instagram, arizona.dispensaries on Insta. And then at Twitter at ADA_Arizona. So find us there on those three places, and I would love to have you there and interact with you.
Yeah, and I, of course, always keep repeating the dispensaries part is pluralized, because that's important if people are going to find you and track you down. Amazing. So I think we want to focus on kind of this amazing transition from medical to adult use, but I think for people to understand how that actually happened, we're going to talk about what the world was like before the vote in November, right? And so maybe that's a really good place to start. Arizona's had a medical program for a long time, but it hasn't really been one that we talk about a ton. It's not like Oklahoma, which is like the constant scuttlebutt of the policy community in cannabis. So can you give us a sense of like how many licenses were we talking about? How many patients? Let's just start talk a little bit about what the regulatory system looked like and what the market looked like pre-legalization, so we can understand how things are going to play out in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that the audience is wonky, not only because it's in the name, but because I am part of that audience. So hopefully the rest of your listeners will appreciate the depth of detail that we'll get into here on this. But where I'll start is that the program was first passed by the voters in 2010, the Arizona Medical Marijuana Act. And at the time, 99 licenses were awarded by the time that all the ramifications of the program went into effect. There were 99 licenses. So our trigger, our kind of justification for how we license is a ratio with the number of pharmacies that operate in the state. So it's a 10-to-1 ratio with the number of pharmacies, and that is a census that the pharmacy board does intermittently throughout their time. When the program first launched, there were 99. And in about 2016, there was an additional 31 licenses that were added. So there are 130 licenses that have been awarded to the medical program. Being awarded a license doesn't mandate that you have to open that retail license. So I think as of yesterday, there were 124 of those 130 licenses that were actually spun up and operational with retail doors attached.
Yeah, and I think that's an important thing to understand, right? Arizona has historically and always been a limited license market, but it's not limited like New York, where they gave, or New Jersey, my home state, where they gave out like 5 licenses, right? It was 99 to start with, and the governor on growth is not the legislature. The governor is pharmacies, which I guess is kind of an arbitrary balancing line, but at least it's not political. It is objective and arithmetic, right, in the sense. Which I think probably has helped.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I'll take this moment to say too that I used the phrase vertically licensed, but I didn't go into detail there. So before you do anything else, you do have to operationalize that retail portion of the license. But each license comes with the ability to have an on-site cultivation, an off-site cultivation, and then a processing facility or kitchen at either one of those on-site or off-site facilities, but not both. This is on the medical side, the medical license there. So you could have a variety of properties, you know, under your roof, so to speak, with that single license. So one of the dynamics that's happened here in Arizona is the leasing of some of those different possibilities. So you might have a particular player, whether an MSO or a single state operator, that really wants to dive into retail, or you might have an operator that really wants to dive into cultivation, and they'll say, all I'm looking for is the ability to lease the chance to, you know, grow under glass, you know, in 5 acres, and I want to really put some great product out because I'm really proud of my genetics, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't want to go through the cost or the rigmarole of having that retail ability. It's not a separate license. It's a private relationship with a license owner to lease that ability to operate. And from the mindset of the regulator, essentially those individuals, companies do not exist. The liability for that operation rests in the license holder or the license owner. So while the Department of Revenue or other regulatory agencies will see those different operators as unique companies or unique, plant touching operations, the licensing body, the Department of Health here in Arizona, only sees 130 of those operators and that they have relationships with.
And that's so interesting. I mean, I think, you know, it's a similar story, not exactly the same factors that we had here in Colorado for a while, where originally we had a medical market that wasn't vertically integrated, that was vertically separated. And then when we adopted our state regulatory framework in 2010 and gave state licenses to marijuana businesses, being the first state to actually give real licenses to marijuana businesses, we forced vertical integration and forced all these people to get married. And then the state had to figure out all of this stuff. I would just go out on a limb to assume that some of the corporate litigators in Arizona probably have some spicy stories that they are not legally allowed to share due to confidentiality. But man, one day over a beer, if you could get them to talk, I got to imagine that those scenarios lead to some complicated business relationships over the years, because it's just, it's kind of almost unnatural, right? Like, if you just want to be a grower, like, just get a grower's license. Don't be forced into a business relationship with a retailer. Like, most of the time, it's probably going to be fine, but there are those times where it probably does not work out well. And, you know, it's just rough for folks. I think that's kind of an area where, you know, our industry probably has been restricted from the normal economic and contractual freedom that your average business has. And it creates some rigmarole for us. It creates some tricky stuff. So, you know, you know, I've got to imagine it was not the easiest thing, but at least they give that kind of flexibility, right? Some markets, you know, were like, no, you can't do that at all. And then obviously the private sector finds a way to do it and the regulators catch you. And then there's like all kinds of tumult. So at least they were like, yes, you can do it. We just are going to go after the actual license holder if someone does something wrong, which, you know, probably only makes for even more complicated business relationships when the grower isn't the licensor, but violates the rules. And then their business partner's like, excuse me, you put us all in jeopardy here. So,
absolutely. Yeah. So those relationships are extremely fraught, and you're totally right that there's some fun conversations once the statute of limitations goes away, right? We can all have conversations over beers or whatnot. But you touched on something there that I just want to highlight, in that the dynamics of the state that we're in are important here, right? So Arizona is the home of Barry Goldwater. We are the home of a variety of different, you know, right of center, pro market, you know, we're the home of the Goldwater Institute, not just Barry Goldwater, but the Goldwater Institute. Right. And I think that context is really important in such that our regulator, who is fantastic, by the way, I'm sure that we have some CANRA members that are listening today. So give Tom Sallow, branch chief over the Department of Health Services, a call and tell him how great he's doing. But just the infrastructure and the ethos of Arizona rulemaking and policymaking is extremely favorable towards market dynamics and kind of letting the market decide on how things roll out. So where some folks are extremely prescriptive and extremely detailed in rulemaking, our regulatory body really kind of sets what that finish line looks like. And then how you run the race is really up to each particular business entity. That isn't to say that our regulations aren't difficult, or that there isn't complexity in that compliance. I mean, you know, our folks have 3-ring binders that are 6 or 7 inches thick, just like everyone else in the industry. But the structure is really, here's what we want to see. Our mandate by the voters is for public health and safety. So we want to meet these thresholds. Beyond these thresholds, we're going to let the market dictate what's successful and what's not. And that's really how that wholesale market came to be, right? As long as the final sale is where the liability stands, then the regulator is fairly permissive on activities that lead up to that, right? So whether it's someone who, you know, is renting a little kitchen space to try out their really great recipe on new brownies, or you know low dose lozenges or something like that, right? Where you know a large MSO isn't going to invest into some mom and pop startup, you know, but that allowance is in there in our rule set. So while we only have 130 licenses, we have probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 to 600 unique operators and brands and products that are available out in the market.
And that's awesome. I definitely wanted to ask a little bit about the wholesale market, but I guess let's put a pin in that for a second, because I think you hit on something that is one of the most interesting themes in cannabis policy. Is from the outside, my guess is your average person probably assumes that more liberal states have the most functional regulated marijuana markets, because that's how we think about things. And I think that what we've seen is that that's not really actually true in practice, because those same liberal states have a tendency towards paternalism, right? And I think that that's so important, of dictating how you are going to get there. And I think, you know, some states are more than others, and they all have different ways. And look, there are quirks everywhere. But I think that, you know, when you look at an Oklahoma, when you look at Arizona, when you look at Colorado, which has become much more liberal, but also has a very strong libertarian bent, you know, those markets tend to be outcome driven in their regulation, not as much process driven. And that's where I think that's where you get into dangerous regulatory situations, is when the rules become process driven. You are defining how the industry is going to operate, and it just always, it never works out, right? It just always is a problem one way or another. And kudos to our regulators that understand that their role is really to define outcomes and protect public health and safety. That's always the North Star. But at the end of the day, you know, you kind of got to let businesses innovate. You kind of have to let, you know, some creativity come to the market, and entrepreneurialism, you know, kind of come to the forefront and be the leader. And so it's really cool to hear about how Arizona may actually have a license limit of 130 licenses, but in practice, because the regulators are outcome focused and because of the nature of investment and product dynamics, you have a lot of different brands and operators working within those licenses. And that's really the key to everything, because that's what meets consumer demand, right? That's going to what is going to lead to a market that gives consumers what they want, which is lots of choices, competitive prices, and obviously, most importantly, not the cops looking over our shoulder trying to put us into cages, because we didn't like that so much as a cannabis community. So how did that come about? Is there a robust, you know, in Colorado, there's a fair amount of vertical integration in the flower market, but a pretty robust market for wholesale products, you know, edibles, tinctures, topicals, all of that kind of stuff. What do you see in Arizona? Is there, from a vertical integration versus wholesale and kind of market dynamic perspective?
Yeah, so I would say that it's definitely a mix, but I think it's trending more towards, you know, folks being drawn like a magnet, or, you know, like a moth to the light as far as where their core competencies might be. So we mentioned our mutual buddy Ryan at the top of the show. So Copper State it excels across the board in a variety of different things, but one of their first core competencies was cultivation. So they had a 40-acre site for cultivation and just recently announced that they've doubled that capacity, and they now have an 80-acre cultivation site. And that was really their market strategy, right? They went to the market with a wholesale flower strategy, and really, you know, their retail brand, which is known as Soul Flower here in the market, was that like second stage of their growth, and they're now excelling in retail. But you have that ability to kind of choose what lane you want to be at, and then furthermore, because of the dynamics we talked about, you can skip a lot of those steps and just say, you know, I have the best history as a chef. And there's a company called Good Things Coming that's attached to that group, just to kind of keep with that Copper State Soul Flower world right now, where an executive chef, kind of known locally for a string of restaurants, signed up his name to the brand, helped with some of the recipes, including their French brownies, which are some of the best brownies on the market, frankly, just like even non-medicated. They're my favorite brownie, but you know, it makes it even better when you put a little oil in it, right? So you know, that's the idea, right? And depending on who your consumer is, depending on who your patient is, they're going to approach you in a variety of different ways. But a lot of those folks even skip the cultivation step, they skip the retail step, and they want to bring, you know, their unique product, whether in the edible space or the beverage space. I think another thing too, if I can just interrupt myself, I guess, to talk about one interesting thing to kind of really drive home that free market mindset here. We've never had any product restrictions at all in Arizona. So while some folks might be really proud of the fact that, you know, they have really new and unique products coming on the market, we've had an intimacy oil probably for about 5 years available on the market. We've had things like enemas available on the market, which is one of the most scientifically defendable practices for cancer patients with extreme pain, right? It's one of the quickest ways to achieve efficacy and results in medication, but no one was making them. So I apologize. I said enema. I meant suppository. Same general category, but, you know, precision matters, I suppose. So you know, we have things like the Listerine breath strips. You know, you can, there's medicated versions of that, chapstick, topicals, all those kinds of things. We've never had any prohibitions or restrictions on, as long as, you know, public health and safety standards are met. So bringing those types of products to market isn't necessarily something that, you know, a huge MSO is going to want to do who's focused on retail principles or retail practices. And our market allows for, you know, that trial and error to happen.
Yeah. And that's awesome. I've always long had a joke that, you know, if you've got an orifice, we're trying to stick weed in it. You know, and I think that there's some truth to that. You know, it's kind of funny.
Medicated Q-tips for your ears, I think. Let's do that.
Yeah, well, I haven't heard any. I don't think I've heard of eardrops yet. I've worked around eye drops, nasal sprays, and suppositories of a variety of kinds. Ears would be new for me, but that sounds kind of cool. I'd be curious as to what that looks like. And it's interesting that you say that. We've never had, a lot of states haven't had product restrictions. Some do, especially in the stricter medical markets where they're like, no, edibles are the devil, and they're like, but capsules are okay and pills are okay. And it's just like, man, you guys need to work on your logic consistency. You're just afraid of like weed gummy bears with weed on them. And that's it. And it's like, all right, I mean, I get that. We probably shouldn't have, shapes like that that are attractive to children in cannabis form. We could certainly support that. But like, it's all about creating that right balance. When those things came up, I'll tell you though, the nasal sprays and the suppositories scared the bejesus out of our regulators. I mean, they were like, oh my God, I can't believe you're doing that. And we would kind of tell them like, well, for people who have chronic migraines, actually a nasal spray is shown to be more effective than a lot of other things. And they were like, oh my, and then we heard from some parents and they were really worried about the suppositories. And that I think was one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard from a concerned parent. And they were like, no, Jordan, you don't understand. The kids in high school, they're going to take those suppositories and they're going to use them in the bathrooms during high school to get high during school. And I'm like, no, like just no. Like if they're doing that, there's nothing you can do to stop them. Like if they've reached that point of desire to getting high during school, like they're going to, and my guess is they're probably just going to eat an edible or smoke a joint in the parking lot. Like, and really, I think that what goes on and what we see is those kind of what we call alternative products here, in Colorado, those are used by like the sickest of the sick people. Those are not the people who are producing those products are not sitting there being like, all right, I'm going to sell as many joints as I can to somebody. They're like, this is for people who have like intestinal cancer, bowel cancer, Crohn's disease, like some of the sickest of the sickest cannabis patients use these products. And they're absolutely critical as a tool to help those people, self-medicate to live more full lives. And so, I think we've found a balance there. There are some risks that they talked about where they were like, look, if you put an edible into your stomach and it goes into a vat of stomach acid, we're a lot less worried about microbial contamination than if you're going to put it up your nose and go right through permeable barriers into your brain. Like, okay, that's cool. We could talk about product safety and regulation, but we don't want to ban them, right? Like we don't want to ban things we're afraid of. We want to understand the risk profile and develop nuanced regulations, because if you just start banning things, one, you don't realize who you're hurting along the way, and two, you're stifling innovation. What if it turns out that as it seems to be, at least anecdotally, that really, really sick people, cannabis suppositories, people with Crohn's and other bowel diseases, like cannabis suppositories are hugely, hugely helpful. We would hate to see a world where we stunt innovation in an area that can help really sick people who need that medicine. So, I think that that's an awesome thing. And it's great that Arizona has had the ability to kind of develop what really seems like a pretty robust and competitive market that if you didn't tell me that the licenses were capped at 130 and we just described the conversation about product variability and opportunity, we would think it looks more like a Colorado, a California than an Oregon, than let's say in New York from a consumer market perspective, which is really important, right? At the end of the day, that's, the people who suffer under limitations on licenses are patients and consumers. And it seems like Arizona's found a way to very interestingly blend, limited licenses with consumer access and a strong amount of product variability, which is fantastic because that's a hard needle to thread. And so all of that sets us up for what's going on now in Arizona, right? Like everything we just talked about is the past, the preconditions that set the stage. And as I understand it, you had a pretty important vote back in November that changed the cannabis future for the state. So why don't we crow a little bit about that and talk about voting margins of victory? Because we always like that.
That's right. I mean, I think 60-40 is pretty impressive. And obviously, it's not the most impressive what happened in last November. But I think, I think one of the things why Arizona is kind of the darling of the ball or whatever phrase you use at the top of the show there, and similarly to Montana, frankly, where in Montana, every statewide office went to a Republican, but yet the cannabis initiative there passed in the high 50s, right? So Arizona did go for Joe Biden by you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 or 11,000 votes, I believe. But then, you know, 2 million people voted for Prop 207, and we won with a margin of 20 points with a 60-40 margin, obviously, there. So I think, you know, what that means to me, and again, I think that the wonks that are listening to the show, and I think that we know that cannabis is not a partisan issue, but I think there's still, that it is a prevailing perception that it is. So I think that bucking of the trend is continuing to be something that's novel, or if I dare say, you know, a little bit sexy, right? Like another red state off the block, right? And that margin, I think, really goes back to our libertarian roots as a state, frankly, right? That you know, we are definitely that, you know, get the government out of my life, you know? Like, there's a lot of ways to really like the idea of the end of prohibition. And whether you're a progressive or a libertarian or somewhere in between, Prop 207 had a lot for you there. And I think that came through with the vote. So, and I think the other thing to say, and I know we'll talk a little bit more about this, right? But I think that we also had the benefit of Prop 207 not being the first bite at the apple. You know, there was a prohibition end attempt in 2016 that we lost by somewhere in the neighborhood of about 2.5 percentage points. And you know, just the natural trend of you know, the public's adoption of the professionalization and normalization of cannabis probably would have won with no changes at all. But we did change the initiative. We listened to the voters who voted against us. And, you know, we were very proud and humbled, frankly, by the overwhelming message that Arizona voters sent. And I know that this will probably change in future elections. But as of right now, more people voted to end cannabis prohibition in Arizona than have voted for anything on the ballot since our founding in 1912. So more votes to the end of prohibition than for the late Senator John McCain, more votes to end prohibition of cannabis in Arizona than any time that Barry Goldwater or Carl Hayden was on the ballot. So really exciting. And of course I'm cheating, you know, population growth is population growth and all of that, but still it's a feather in my cap, and I'll wear it proudly.
Yeah. I'm certainly not going to call shenanigans on you for that one. I like it. I think that that's a really important way to think about things and understand the growth and advocacy and progress that we're making as a movement. You know, I remember election night in 2016. For a hot minute there, you guys were the most depressing thing of the night. And then the Orange Menace was installed into DC, and all of a sudden the loss in Arizona became secondary from a concern for the future of our country standpoint. And it was so close. And I think even leading into that night, we kind of knew that Arizona was, I don't want to say a long shot, because you don't come 2.5 percentage points away from victory as a long shot, but it was of all the states that were on the ballot that year, Arizona was like, man, if we could get that one, it would be wild. And then we turn around, and before you know it, you know, you guys come back with another initiative and you just crush it, right? I mean, 60-40 is a serious, serious win total to be able to have. So kudos to you guys. And, you know, I think, listen, whether you could or couldn't have won without listening to the concerns, like, that's not responsible policymaking, right? Like, responsible policymaking, being the grownups in the room, being the ones who are right on cannabis policy, does mean that we need to listen to the concerns of everybody. That doesn't mean we need to adopt their policy proposals. There's a big difference between people saying they're concerned about something and us listening to what they're suggesting as a solution for it. But kudos to you for saying, hey, we could win this anyway, but we're going to listen to what people were concerned about. And we're going to try to make sure that, to the extent those concerns are valid, and we can come up with reasonable policy proposals to solve them, that you do, because that really is, you know, leadership on cannabis policy is not about having the most marijuana sold. Leadership on cannabis policy is not about having the most number of patients or anything else. It is about being forward thinking and understanding that as we embark on this journey of ending prohibition and hopefully ending the drug war writ large across the board, understanding that that doesn't mean drugs are harmless. cannabis isn't harmless. It is medicine. And like many forms of medicine, it has side effects and other things that happen to people. What we need to be doing is understanding risks, educating people on those, and identifying situations and smart policies that can mitigate those risks outside of a prohibitionist mindset that will only result in patient suffering and human beings put in cages. And that is, you know, those, at least for us, those are our bright lines, right? Patients need access. Human beings don't go into cages for marijuana. And then let's talk, right? Like, then let's talk about what we need to do to make sure that we can keep public health and public safety as the North Star. Because what we've seen in a lot of states is ending prohibition and regulation is actually a public health and public safety forward policy. It improves those outcomes by both shedding light on things, and as we like to say, regulation works, get over it. And more importantly, it also raises revenue. So if there are problems, we now have funding to deal with it, not just money out the door, putting people into cages and paying cops, but actually tax revenues that can fund mental health and other intervention services should people have problems. And so, you know, it's great that you guys were proactive, I think, above all, in saying, hey, we're not putting our head in the sand and saying, well, we're going to win, so we don't care. You're saying we have a responsibility here, right? Cannabis legalization is not a privilege. It's a responsibility to do the right thing, to make sure we can end prohibition here in Colorado, in Arizona, at the federal level, and eventually throughout the world. And if we're not responsible and if we're not proactive, then the public is not going to trust us. And prohibition could continue, and people will suffer, and we got to stop that. So, I guess, why don't we talk, what are a couple of some of the defining aspects of that initiative? Like, how are we, you know, what are the top two or three things that when you think about, you know, that makes Arizona's initiative unique, other than the transition timeline? So let's talk about the top two, three things that aren't transition. And then let's talk about the transition, which is maybe the thing everybody's been waiting a good 30 minutes or so listening to this, wanting to hear about. But y'all have to wait just a little bit longer.
Perfect. Well, I'd be happy to talk about that, because I think, frankly, some of those other provisions are why, you know, we didn't win with a 50% plus one margin, but instead we won 60-40. And that really had to do with a comprehensive look at the decades, if not centuries, long body of failed policy towards criminalizing drugs and criminalizing cannabis specifically. So in addition to 26 social equity licenses that will be awarded at a future date once those rules have been promulgated by the Department of Health, there was a significant portion of dollars highlighted to be reinvested through a community reinvestment program that actually in some ways mirrors the work that Colorado has done around community justice reinvestment. And in addition to that, expungement is a significant portion. The local chapter of the ACLU here in Arizona estimates somewhere between 200 and 250,000 individuals will benefit from the expungement provisions that are now technically in effect, but not applicable until July 12th. Just to be clear, the delay in that applicability really was intended to just give the court system here in Arizona the time to develop the rules and procedures to make that process happen. But we're very excited to help support that, and the legal fees and kind of the assistance for all of that is to be paid for through the fees collected for and tax revenue developed by that program. So we're very, very excited and hopeful for that comprehensive look at restorative justice. It isn't just about providing additional access to communities that have historically been on the margin of the industry in terms of ownership, but also, you know, doing a broad-based attempt at some work to repair the damage that's been done over the last decades and centuries.
Yeah, and I think that that's so important, and I'm glad that those were the provisions you chose to highlight, because, you know, I think it goes without saying, obviously, communities of color were disproportionately victimized in the war on cannabis, and there are a lot of people who are just victims of cannabis prohibition and communities that have been decimated from the war on drugs for over 100 years, and it's our ongoing responsibility. You know, marijuana legalization is not a fixed point in time. It's an ongoing process to unwind those harms, and, you know, although I appreciate your shout out in Colorado, I will admit that we have a long way to go. It's kind of the tricky part of going first. You know, we didn't get to talk about all these fun things. We were just like, darn, can we actually end prohibition? Oh my God, we did. And like all of those, all the things that I think we all personally would have loved to see in there were just probably really risky politically in 9 years ago now. And now we're talking about a completely different world where you can get a 60-40 vote on something that involves, you know, social equity licenses, that involves expungement, that involves community reinvestment. And those are some of the most important things. And Colorado is catching up. We sent our low income or our low interest loan program to the governor's desk already this legislative session for social equity businesses. And our firm is serving as the lead proponent. And thanks to our sponsor, Alex Valdez, we're running a bill that would increase possession limits and change a bunch of record sealing statutes as it relates to cannabis, because we think that that's important. You know, we don't just do work for the industry. We're the stewards of cannabis reform, and it requires, you know, constant tinkering to continue to do those things. And we're really proud to be able to work on those things, because at the end of the day, if you were a victim of cannabis prohibition, it's going to hurt your life one way or another. And whether you want to come into the industry, if you do, you are so welcome and we're so happy to have you. But if you want to go do something else, we still want to make sure that that stain is removed, right? And that that you have access to full parental rights and full employment rights and full housing rights. Because the message of ending cannabis prohibition is not that from here forth, everything is cool. It was, oh, darn, we really messed up and shouldn't have done that as a society. And that if that is the message, and I think should be the message, we have to look back and right some of those wrongs to the best we can. And so glad you're doing it. It is not easy. This record sealing stuff is a lot harder than people, you know, it's very easy to say and write. It's a lot harder because most states, and I'm guessing Arizona, given the fiscal situation and kind of political history, probably doesn't have the most organized criminal records in the world. Most people don't realize that most states don't have digitized police records. And so if you want to start going out expunging records and sealing records, you're usually navigating some like paper system that feels like it's from the 1950s half the time. And it's a lot of work. So, you know, it takes a lot of money and it takes investment to be able to do it. And the only way you get that is if you prioritize it. So kudos for prioritizing those things and focusing on what is obviously the most important aspect of cannabis reform, which is righting the wrongs of 100 years of the drug war.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you.
Yeah. It's something I've been thinking about. I had the privilege of testifying on Wednesday when our bill got out of committee 8-3 about this. So I might be a little warmed up and a little fired up on this topic, but I'm really proud of.
So if you call me Mr. Chair, I'll know.
Yeah. No, thankfully I managed to get through that. I got really lucky. We have the Colorado Criminal Defense Bar is also supporting it. So they sent all the really hard questions to Tristan Gorman, who is absolutely fantastic. She just crushed it in committee. And I got to thank her for taking all the hard ones and thank the committee and then just give some rah-rah drug legalization speech. So it worked out great and we're super happy to be doing it. And so that's part of it. The other part of it is, as a cannabis consumer, maybe we're a little selfish and we think that we should have access to safe products not produced in the illicit market. And Arizona, I think, holds the absolute record by a wide margin of time from vote to first sale
to an adult use consumer. And I don't think it's close at this point. I can't think of anybody that's done it in like, what was it, like 90 days, it feels like, about, give or take?
75, actually, yeah.
75 days. So
good luck. I've heard some states that are moving forward are trying to break that record. Clearly not Virginia, who just is trying to legalize marijuana in 2024, even though that's 3 years from now. We still appreciate your progress, Virginia, but maybe you should look over to Arizona and be like, yeah, 75 days is less than 3 years. So how did you actually accomplish that, right? I think that's what everybody wants to know, is like, how did you do it?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think, you know, in some ways, and I don't mean to be glib, and I don't mean to obfuscate the real answer, but I think it's important to know that you know, the journey of 75 days. In fact, let me back up. My wife hates the fact that I eat at Jimmy John's as much as I do, but I do. And one of their new, slogans or whatever is that it takes 6 hours to make your sandwich in 30 seconds or less. And I think that the story of our 75-day turnaround starts in 1996. And actually, folks sometimes forget the fact that we passed a medical marijuana program the same year that California did. But what happened is our legislature, one of the first acts they did in the next legislative session was invalidate that initiative, right? So our public, our voting public is in some way conditioned to understanding the idea of a marijuana program, of a cannabis program in regulated commerce for over 20 years, now 25 years, right? So we successfully went back to the ballot in 2010 with a medical program. And those producers, those winners of the licenses at that time are the operators that built relationships with our regulator over the course of the subsequent decade. So the 75-day flipping of the switch is really a story of a decade worth of relationship building with our regulator and building of that trust. And, you know, we had and continue to have an extremely robust medical program. As of the last report, which just came out last week, we have about 300,000, just a touch over 300,000 qualified patients in our medical program. So it wasn't something that was a very small program that was flipping to, you know, an incredible exponential multiple of all those 21 and over. Now, I will say, you know, 300,000 qualified patients to 5.5 million Arizonans over 21 is a fairly big delta. But, you know, and policymakers know that that's not really, you know, not all 5.5 million of those folks are going to walk in the door. And even likely not all 2 million people that voted yes on Prop 207 are going to walk in our doors. Right. It's probably still going to be somewhere in the 9 to 11% of the general population that, you know, is somewhat irregular consumers and they're going to walk through our door. But that being said, you know, the regulators had the trust of the operators and the operators had the trust of the regulator to move quickly on this, right? And we were extremely prepared and by no means am I taking any credit away from the Department of Health. In fact, the opposite, the relationship that we have as an association of operators and the regulators, the Department of Health, is very collaborative. They still find my members. They still cite my members for deficiencies on a regular basis. But we have a quarterly standing meeting with the Department of Health where we mutually bring up issues with, you know, the other party, and we talk through these issues, right? So, and the conversations around getting ready for an adult use market began as soon as Governor Ducey signed the official canvas on November 30th. So the first set of draft rules came out towards the end of 2020. I think it was somewhere around like December 19th or December 20th. I was told that it was a coincidence. But I will say, because I was refreshing every 30 seconds that day, that the rules dropped at 4:20 in the afternoon on December 19th. So I think there was perhaps a little bit of cognition of the importance of that time. But the long and the short of it is that, you know, we had a very robust and successful medical program. So that the flipping of the switch was not ever going to be as convoluted or complicated in some of these other markets where it was a complete separate set of operators that was coming into the market. Those 130 medical operators are the 130 operators of the adult use program. Now there's additional licensure that's coming down the pike, and I'm sure that we'll get into that right now, but the early applicants were essentially defined as current operators. So the 130 medical licenses are now co-located and 130 adult use licenses as well. So medical patients and recreational consumers walk through the same door, they go up to the same register, and it, by and large, it's the same cannabis. The largest differences are one has an excise tax of 16% on top of the retail classification sales tax. We call it TPT here in Arizona. We're one of six states to do that. And then the other difference is that there are dosage controls. We did not go in the direction of a THC cap like some states are contemplating. We did dosage caps. So edibles can be sold in packages of no more than 100 milligrams and dosed no more than 10 milligrams. And those either have to be scored or otherwise delineated within that package of 100 milligrams. So, you know, with that exception and with that caveat, it's the same cannabis, it's the same door you walk through, and it's the same register you make your purchase at.
Yeah. And so I think maybe the sum up of the story is if you want to move as quickly between medical to adult use or move as quickly through initiative to legalization, you need a robust medical market, because I think, yes, there are those 130 licenses, but we talked about, you're actually talking about like 600 or so businesses that are actually, or brands and operators, right, underneath those licenses. You're talking about an industry that's been around long enough to mature and develop relationships with regulators and have those relationships, right? A productive system involves a very healthy relationship and dialogue between regulator and regulatee. They certainly do have to sanction folks from time to time, but the best system is one where everyone is working together, focused on the North Star, right? Public health and safety. And so those things, absolutely, like those are the preconditions. And then third, you allowed those operators to transition very quickly and minimized regulatory barriers, right? Which I think we've seen a lot of states is like, okay, well, now that we're going to adult use, we have to rethink everything. And the truth is you don't. Medical patients shouldn't have to pay taxes, and medical patients shouldn't have potency restrictions on their edibles. That's about it. I mean, like in Colorado today, give or take, that's basically the difference between medical and retail, medical and adult use, right? Adult use, you know, you can't buy more than 100 milligrams in a package, and you have to buy 10 milligram servings that are scored or easily separable. And that's exactly the kind of proactive public safety policy that the industry helped create, the industry supported, our firm helped create here in Colorado after initial aspects of legalization. But if you keep it simple, and you stop with the fear mongering, because marijuana is not as scary as some people think it is, you end up in a situation where the transition is easy and simple and can move very quickly. But I think the other lesson is it is not something that you can say, hey, I want to do what Arizona did today. You have to live the journey that Arizona has lived for 25 years to be able to go from medical to retail in 75 days, right? That is a how you did it was through a unique set of conditions that are certainly replicable, but they are not replicable almost today consciously. Like they have to exist or have been existing for enough time. And that's how you kind of get to that. And so when you hear states in other states that I've heard, you know, New Mexico, for an example, where they're like, how do we do what Arizona did? And I was like, get a time machine. And go back a long time ago. And there are things that certainly can be done to move very quickly. But I don't think people realize that it was the unique confluence of circumstances in Arizona that allowed for this to happen. And that it's very hard to intentionally manufacture 10 years of relationships between regulator and regulatee, right? Like that's how it happened. That's because at the end of the day, it was a trust issue.
Yeah, absolutely. So to your point, what I would say there is, and this is pure speculation, right? But I think that, you know, with that set of facts, I think that there are potentially two markets that could do this as quick as Arizona did, and that's Pennsylvania and Florida, just because of their relative maturity in medical relationships and the potential that they have to, you know, flip that switch. Of course, Florida has a political mess, as does Pennsylvania, that they have to work through. But if you get the politics aside, I think that they are structurally set up in a similar way in terms of market maturity and medical market understanding that switch could be flipped relatively quickly. I don't see, you know, I don't, as much as I would love to be the gold standard, I don't think it makes sense for other markets to be able to expect that 75-day turnaround, right? You know, yeah. Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither was Arizona's regulated cannabis ecosystem.
Yeah. Maryland might be a good example too. You know, they have a good, robust medical market. You know, New York and New Jersey, probably a lot dicier. Like those are much smaller, numbers of licenses. New Mexico, smaller program, you know, and so that's, you know, I think it is. I think that's a good call. Like you see some states out there and you're like, okay, you've been operating long enough. You know, you do have similar conditions to Arizona. We may see other states try to do it, but I think that the success success that you've had is all of the stuff that we've talked about. So, all right, we talked about the way the world was. We talked about how you did what was so amazing. Now let's talk about the future. Like, let's talk a little bit about future licenses coming online. What do we see for market growth and expansion? Because obviously, you know, Arizona is a great cannabis market. It's a great state. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there, given that balance between desire for cannabis, but also that great libertarian bent that we like to see for innovation. And so what are the kind of things that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, while we are a mature medical market, I think our ecosystem definitely has a lot of room to continue to mature. I think that one of the reasons why Arizona has flown under the radar for so long is that we are literally under the radar. We live in the shadow of the two most mature regulated ecosystems in the country, in California and Colorado. So, you know, the dynamic that folks were talking about with New Jersey kind of being the first domino for the Northeast, in some senses, Arizona's among the last dominoes in the West. So we have some catching up to do in terms of maturity and kind of, you know, the robustness. But, you know, I would put the flower that I am lucky enough to be able to consume here in Arizona up against almost anything that I've ever had the pleasure of consuming in California or Colorado. And so, you know, I'm not like trying to start any, like, you know, regional wars or anything, but
like everybody should get great weed everywhere. Like, there it grows on trees. Right. There is no limit. The world can produce an unlimited amount of amazing cannabis. We just want safe product for those who want to consume it. Shay, I don't know if you need to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. To get back to the conversation about what the new licenses are, I'll go back to that ratio that we talked about at the beginning. So the organic growth in medical licenses will always have the opportunity or the possibility of growing as more pharmacies enter into the Arizona market. So the pharmacy board will continue to do their census in a periodic basis. And, there'll be an opportunity to naturally grow in medical licenses as we move forward. The two additional opportunities for licensure that were a result of Prop 207 were the social equity program, which we talked about. So there are 26 licenses that will be awarded through that program. And then the other one is what has been kind of colloquially known as the empty county program. So a provision of the initiative was that any county in Arizona that has fewer than two dispensaries will have a lottery to award licenses to those counties. So for folks who do not have Google Maps up on their phone or on the computer right now, Arizona has 15 counties. Maricopa County is where the city of Phoenix is. The Pima County is where the city of Tucson is. And those are our two largest metropolitan areas. And you kind of look up in the center of the state, you know, Pima County, Pinal County, Maricopa County, Yavapai County, and Coconino County are relatively well populated, and none of those counties are have fewer than two. But the balance of those counties, of which we have 15 total, there is either zero licenses or only one license in there. So which means that there's, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 12 licenses that will be awarded via lottery. That that application process closed on Tuesday, March 9th. The Department of Health received just shy of 400 applications for that program. They now have, they're in the process of a 10-day cure period. So if there are any deficiencies in those applications, the applicants have the opportunity to cure those applications. Once that closes, the department will set a date. We expect that to be in April. For that lottery to commence. And then those individuals who win those licenses have the opportunity to open them. And those licenses will be adult use only, but they will come with, quote unquote, everything that comes with a license now, right? So a retail, an on-site cultivation, an off-site cultivation, and processing facilities associated with that. One thing that I'll mention is there is a clawback provision of sorts in that if the license is not operationalized within 18 months, it is assumed to be forfeited. It's a small thing, but just to let you know, there are 130 licenses currently a part of our program, but only 124 retail doors that are open. So somewhere out there, there are 6 licenses that only exist in paper form in our program. Now, I'm relatively certain that those 6 will be operational really soon, but to get ahead of that issue, in the future, that provision was put into the rules as a part of this program. So if any of these 8 to 12 licenses that are awarded as a part of the empty counting program are not operationalized within a year and a half, they will be forfeited and a lottery will happen again.
So the system is built to design and expand out, I think, over time is probably one of the important things to understand. And there is going to be opportunities for new licensure, some dedicated for social equity, some part of the general market expansion. Is that, and then we'll see what the future holds. I mean, who the heck knows? I think anybody who thinks they know what the cannabis world is going to look like 10 years from now probably couldn't have predicted where we are today in 2011. I'm just going to go out on a limb. And I'll tell you this much, Jordan, 2011, living back in New Jersey, working at the state legislature as a mere cannabis consumer on the sidelines of the war on drugs, certainly did not think by any stretch of any imagination that we would be here today. And that I wasn't even sure if I would ever live to see a world like we have today. And the amount of progress that we've made on the war on drugs in this short period of time. So, we will have to continue to monitor things, I guess, just for closing, cause we're coming up towards the end of the show, outside of some of this new license expansion, is there any other kind of regulatory change that we see on the horizon that folks should be aware of, whether it's a new innovation or, I know you guys have testing that you're getting caught up with, and that's kind of been a dicey, maybe that's too deep a rabbit hole to go down at an hour in. But what's the one other thing other than market expansion that you've been thinking about and that we should watch for in Arizona in the months or year to come?
Absolutely. And thanks for the opportunity to bring this up. I think, part of the role that I have is to not necessarily just take a look at supporting our members through current events, but also take a moment to kind of see what's on the horizon. And I think for me, in the seat that I sit in, interstate commerce and international trade are two of those big topics for us, not only because of some of those dynamics that we talked about earlier, in that we are, essentially, one of the last dominoes in the West to go through this end of prohibition activity, but also because, we border another country here in Arizona, right? And I think that a lot of the international trade conversation has been, focused on Canada. They have a relatively mature legal market up there. Many of those companies are publicly traded on the exchanges and all of those dynamics that we don't have to go into here. But, south of the border, the Mexican Congress is rapidly developing the framework for a regulated ecosystem for cannabis. And if we federally legalize here in America, in the United States, Mexico is also America, right? But if we do that federal legalization, I think that we're going to need to have some honest and proactive conversations around what that interstate commerce looks like and what international trade looks like in a state like ours, right? So in other industries, Arizona is proud of its posture as the gateway between Mexico and Canada, right? The Canamex Highway runs directly through Arizona. And a lot of that produce, right? About 75% of the lettuce that everyone listening to this, and in fact, everyone around the world, consumes in winter months is grown in Yuma, Arizona, in the southwest corner of our state. That trade happens across industries, and there's no logical conclusion that one can run to is if we're moving towards the end of federal prohibition, and multiple nations are also working towards that end of federal prohibition, we need to have honest conversations at the state level to kind of take a look at what that looks like for our market. So I think, the first reaction, that knee-jerk reaction of current operators, is to kind of say, whoa, 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 we just got here. we like, let's take a look at maybe some of the opportunity that we have to build out our market. And that's a valid point, and that's a valid conversation. I don't think this conversation is a tomorrow thing, but if we're talking about next month, next year, next decade, I you know, to your point about 2011, if we're looking at 2031, 2041, we're going to have interstate commerce. We're going to have international trade. And those are conversations that our market here in Arizona is best served by having today. So we're not having them, you know, on you know, the eve of the launch of interstate commerce. So those are some of the things that I'm spending my time digging into and taking a look at with some level of seriousness.
Yeah, I think that that's awesome. That is one of the topics that I think I'm so glad you brought up, because it is one of the wonkiest Weed Wonks topics you could possibly get into. We've talked about it a bunch in the past on the show with Adam Smith and a good friend of ours. And it's something that I think is underconsidered, right? Like, I think that one of the cool things we could do on this show is bring, you know, as many of the policy wonks in cannabis together and talk about these things, because we need to prepare our members, our clients, our employers for this reality. Robert Mikos, who's a constitutional law professor at Vanderbilt, really good guy, actually just put out an essay that talks about interstate commerce issues from a constitutional perspective in cannabis. And those two issues are always, one, residency requirements, shockingly not constitutional. I know it's crazy, but they're totally not constitutional, have never been and will never be. And then the second thing is, he talks about this idea of the existing restraint on interstate commerce and the impact on federalism. And he also concludes, like, not going to work. Like, there will be interstate commerce. There eventually will be international trade. Cannabis industry has an opportunity to develop and get its feet wet as a domestic only market. And I think that that gives a lot of our businesses an interesting opportunity to build competitive advantages and do some really cool stuff. But like, it is coming. There is nothing anyone is going to do to stop it. And so it is so important for folks like us and in these conversations and with businesses to let them know about these kinds of things, because they need to start thinking about how it's going to affect them so they can continue to do all the great things that they do. And so, with that, I think that's the perfect place to close. I mean, I couldn't think of a nerdier topic for us to talk about at the very end than that. And I'll just say, you know, Sam, thank you so much for jumping on. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us. If you want to give any closing remarks, please share any final thoughts you have. And then we'll let everybody wrap up in their Friday, because it's 4 o'clock here and the witching hour is impending quite quickly, at least in Colorado.
Yes, sir. Well, Jordan, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you directly, and also just the general community of Weed Wonks out there. Great to be here. Again, I'll just kind of plug the association socials and all that. So check us out on Instagram at arizona.dispensaries, on Twitter at @ADA_Arizona. And you can reach out to me directly at sam@azdispensaries with an IES.org. It's been great to be here and looking forward to continuing the conversation offline with any and all of you.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much. The great Sam Richard from the Arizona Dispensaries Association. Always fun to catch up with you about policy stuff, and actually this time record it for everyone else to listen to. So happy Friday and stay nerdy, everybody. All right, Shay, make the magic.